Welcome to the Legacy Podcast Series from Chapter 4 Uganda. Visit us at chapter4uganda.org to subscribe, receive a newsletter and updates on our work and that of our partners on civil liberties in Uganda. Welcome. We are at the studios here somewhere in Kampala because of my guess we shall say an undisclosed location somewhere in Kampala. So let me have my guest first introduce himself for that reason.
Thank you. My name is Moses Karis Oteba, and I work in the field of protecting those who promote human rights. So I am a human rights defender, and I wouldn't say the frontline human rights defender, but the second line, the one that watches the back of those who do the frontline human rights defending.
So explain to our audience, first of all, what a protection officer like yourself does.
Protection basically is about measures, strategies that are put in place to ensure that whatever is being protected is free from harm. So what I do is design and implement measures that will keep human rights defenders safe and secure as they do their work.
What kind of dangers do human rights defenders face in Uganda or generally in East Africa? Because my understanding is that your work is not only just within the jurisdiction here in Uganda.
Our work is across the region of Africa, and pretty much like in most of sub-Saharan Africa, the challenges that Ugandan human rights defenders face, usually as a result of working in repressive environments, a civil space that is fast shrinking. And so what human rights defenders do is they speak truth to power and are always trying to push back on this shrinking space. As you speak truth to power and try to push back on shrinking space, certainly not everybody is going to be affected positively. Some people's interests are affected negatively, and usually these people whose interests are affected negatively and they have the power, they are going to respond. They're going to attack in many ways. Now, the state actors, for instance, because they have all the state mechanisms, they are going to arrest, detain, even unlawfully. They are going to surveil online. They are going to intimidate. They are going to physically assault. Yeah. And we're not only talking about state actors, even non-state actors. You know, those in business, the general population whose interests are affected negatively, they are going to respond. Sometimes it is, you know, coloring. They paint you in a manner that's not pleasant. Blackmail. Sometimes it is verbal assault. Sometimes it is sheer discrimination. Yeah. And I mean, it comes in all sorts of ways. Sometimes it's physical, sometimes it's digital attacks, sometimes it's psychological attacks.
So tell me, Moses, in the course of this year, for example, your typical human rights defender, though we have to get to the definition of that in a bit, when they walk into your offices, what are they complaining about?
2024 has been an interesting year. Like I just mentioned, the shrinking spaces have caused a transfer of activism. We're seeing a shift from physical activism, meeting in physical spaces, more to online activism. And so online activism and human rights defending on digital platforms has seen arise, because we can no longer go to the streets to peacefully protest, because we can no longer have access to certain spaces, physical spaces that we had previously, because we don't have a certain physical audience that we had previously. Activism is going online, increasingly online. And I'm speaking from across, from the perspective of across Africa. We're seeing young people, especially the younger activists, engaging more online, because physical audiences are interfered with. Physical audiences are limited. Activism has shifted more online. And so the nature of attacks now are also more online-based. But usually these online attacks tend to translate to physical attacks. But the most that we have seen this year has been online attacks, cyber bullying and harassment, doxing, surveillance online. And this has sometimes resulted into physical assault, you know, breaking into people's houses and offices.
So, okay, so I am a human rights defender. I congregate online with my friends and like-minded people. We speak truth to power. And I imagine that in that online space, there is an extended freedom, because unlike, you know, holding placards at a street corner or next to parliament, you're not really limited what you can say or do online, right? So you say you say whatever you're saying. And also, unlike the physical space, say if you're at a square, a public square or something, your audience actually is limited. But here you have got potentially thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions listening to you. Okay? That particular human rights defender then opens themselves up to being surveilled, but they're not really hiding, okay? Being identified, but they're not really hiding either. What makes this current situation unique, would you say, is not just that there's greater amplification online, but also that the nature of online engagement also means that human rights defenders are competing for audiences with, say, people who have an interest in...
Certainly.
Yeah, like political groups, mm-hmm. with various ideologies and many other things. Is this unique environment where you've got an intersection of technology and general problems of, you know, of politics and society, has that made your work significantly different?
The role of technology in both politics, human rights activism, and defending cannot be downplayed. Of course, there is a positive element to it, the fact that information proliferation of information is much faster now. Information is available more easily. The other side to that is that not everybody has access to this information. At the same time, there is an elite society. There is a digitally, you know, a section of society that is aged out because of their lack of digital skills, lack of ability, lack of access to these, to internet and all of that. So there is a positive side to it, but there's also the downside to it when it comes to inclusion, for instance. Now, and you know, there is the whole issue, the concern around mis and disinformation. Now, information that is online is not only correct and true information. Sometimes it's deliberately wrong information that is being sent out there, depending on the interests of who the orchestrator or the originator of this information is. And so, for instance, if somebody wants to take away your voice online, that's much easier now. Come up with a story. And now the AI factor is also, you know, spanning out really fast. You can feature in a movie even without being in the location where the movie is being shot. You know, that wrong information sent out there about you, that misinformation or that distortion, disinformation, from a deviation from what the correct information is. I mean, correcting it once it's out there is complex. It's difficult. It's difficult. I keep saying, if your nudes, whether genuine nudes or not, leaked, it's such a dent on your image as a human rights activist, especially for women. That brings them down completely. It completely devoices you, even online. Yeah.
Have you, if you can be candid about it, have you dealt with, okay, let me say, what is the worst case you've dealt with, without mentioning names, of a human rights defender, man or woman, who has been attacked in this fashion online?
I mean, there are several. There are several. Bringing it home, I typically remember an incident where somebody was being trolled online, and disinformation, I would say disinformation about their personal, you know, family, sexual life, was being, you know, sprayed out there. And this person was emotionally, completely drained, emotionally affected, psychologically. A psychological impact on them was huge. They had to take some time away. Just take some time away. And, you know, only through counseling were they able again to come back, you know, come back and resume what they were doing. And then the other incident again within Uganda was the case of an activist who had to leave their house, you know, an online activist who had to stay away from their residence in hiding for some time because from the online activism they were doing, they were being doxxed, they were being trolled, they were being surveilled. So now what they were doing online is translating to physical attacks at their home. Their dog was killed, the perimeter wall to their residence compromised. They couldn't just stay in their house. Those were strong signals. They were not gathering people in physical spaces. They were rallying people online for a cause that was genuine, for a cause that everybody wanted to, you know, have their say about.
So you've given two scenarios, right? One, an online activist gets removed from their place of comfort. They don't have access to their home. And I imagine that what, as a human rights defender, that you did was make it possible for them to find a safe location while the threat is addressed.
That's right.
Then the second scenario is even more interesting because here you have got someone who is shamed online, and the effects of that on them psychologically is that they could not continue doing what they were doing.
Yeah.
In a way, the human rights defense would have been activists should avoid being detained, being imprisoned, but this new scenario with the technology is such that you can be right where you are and you are still disabled. So would you say that some of the things that have changed in the course of the last, like, you know, that half decade is that you are having to provide a lot more mental health resources to human rights activists?
Certainly. Yes, certainly. And it's not just a thing of this decade. It's just that we are coming to that realization in the recent years. But from as old as when activism started, it's always had a threefold impact. It's always had a threefold impact. The physical integrity of the human rights defender, the information integrity of a human rights defender, but also the psychological integrity of the human rights defender, and the attackers are careful to attack in all the three dimensions. Yes, if they can't get your information, if they can't get you physically, then they target you psychologically, mentally. And I'm wondering why it took us this long to discover or to begin to come up with interventions that are rather psychological. To be honest, the COVID and the lockdown period, the pandemic, when we struggled with the pandemic, it helped a bit to highlight this mental and psychological dimension to the challenges that human rights defenders face. It amplified it.
How, if I may? Because Uganda had one of the most severe lockdowns globally, one of the longest. It lasted for over a year.
The first lockdown was, I think, a whole 9 months, six into nine, and then the second lockdown.
Yeah, well, I think I read somewhere that it was almost a 2 year period of disruptions.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Because everywhere during the pandemic, you had mental health issues that various communities were dealing with because of the confinement.
Yes.
But what you're saying is that even in the context of all that, you know, the disease and the public health challenges, you have this vulnerable group whose main task,
yes,
well, and normally would put them in danger.
Yes.
So they were facing sort of like a double jeopardy. Mm. How did that reveal itself?
You see, when I say that the pandemic played a significant role in enhancing psychological interventions, this is how I mean. There are two things about human rights defenders. One is it's very difficult for a human rights defender to acknowledge their vulnerability, to get vulnerable and acknowledge their weakness in the face of whatever challenge. A human rights defender is typically, prone to position themselves as the iron man, as the iron woman, as the iron person.
They have to put up a brave face because the odds are against them anyway.
That's right. They have to put up that brave face. They have to put up that brave show. Yes. And so acknowledging that I am struggling does not come off easily. The pandemic brought all of us to a place where, you know, we all had to admit, and I am struggling, you know. We all had to admit that it's difficult. We're all facing difficulty. And so that general acknowledgement softened people's hearts to acknowledge that they are challenged and to reach out for help. So the typical human rights defender learned to reach out for help, even mental and psychological health, when they need it. The second thing that came through is that the perceptions around mental health started to change. The typical African understanding of mental health was, you're cuckoos, you're mad. And it aligned, it tended to be categorized more with caste, spirituality, demonic, you know, activity and all of that. It wasn't looked at in the light of what it really is. Yeah. So that stigma around mental health has significantly been broken. It's been broken. And people know that, mental health issues are real and everybody is prone to them. You don't have to be evil. You don't have to be, you know, demon possessed. You don't have to be embroiled in witchcraft and all of this spiritual stuff to have a mental problem. It's normal. Yeah. The normalization of the concept of mental health. We haven't achieved the full normalization of mental health issues. There is still a certain level of stigma, but that has been broken significantly. That wall has come down. So people are now freer to talk about their mental health challenges. People are now freer to to reach out without feeling a sense of, you know, shame, a sense of guilt, that stigma has sort of waived.
In the human rights community, and in your line of work, I imagine as a service, you also have had to adapt, to learn and relearn this new environment. What kinds of assistance do you provide to someone who might be facing, you know, psychological stress by virtue of this work that they're doing?
The very first thing is I'll just tell a short story that my late mother told me when I first had the conversation with her that I intended to go the line of psychology. She told me a story of a young girl, 5-year-old, whose mother sent her down to the well to bring water, and she took the whole day. She spent a really long time, and the mother got worried. So just at the point when the mother begins to look for her, she then shows up, the 5-year-old girl shows up, and the mother asks her, "Where have you been?" Said, "I was down, delayed helping a friend of mine." So curious to know what exactly had happened, the mother asks, "So what happened?" And the little girl says, "My friend's doll was broken." And the mother asks, "Did you fix it? What did you do?" He said, "No, I sat down and cried with her." Yeah. I mean, sometimes all that it takes is to sit down and listen and empathize with somebody. So the very first support that we provide in the dimension of mental health and psychological needs is that empathy, just being able to empathize with somebody, sit down and listen to them and listen with concern to them is one very important and, you know, step in the direction of mental health interventions for human rights defenders. But other interventions are, you know, providing support for rest and respite. Sometimes people just need to take a break from their work, from whatever it is that is causing them stress, to just recharge and resource resilience. We provide support to see a therapist for counseling and for whatever other form of therapy that the person might need. We provide capacity building, in areas of self-care, in areas of stress management, in areas of resourcing resilience, and in areas of providing psychosocial support and care to others. So we build people's capacity. We organize therapy camps, we organize conferences, we organize workshops. Yeah, basically to create awareness and share knowledge and skills about mental health and human rights activism.
Would you say going into 2025, which in Uganda is an election year, that this constitutes both the technology and how it's interacting with activism and this mental health dimension? Are these like the two new frontiers for human rights defense, and that's where you'll significantly spend your time next year?
It looks like that's where the trend is tending towards. That's where there's going to be needed more attention. That's where we need to shine the spotlight. That's where we need to focus a bit more of our energies in 2025. It's going to be more difficult. And actually, the general population has been psychologically conditioned to be afraid to go out into these physical spaces. I am really doubtful that many people are going to attend rallies, many people, especially those that are in opposition. I doubt that many of them are going to have the courage to physically show up we are in a space where the military is pronouncing itself in ways unprecedented, yeah, about, you know, the elections and political future of this country. It's sending fear out there, and not many people have the courage to speak out, especially if their opinion, if their view is divergent to that of the ruling party. Yeah, so we'll have a lot more people taking solace and activating from their place of comfort, which is online. Yeah, because online, then you can do this anonymously. Online, then you can, you know, do this in ways that do not necessarily expose you if you are to do this physically. So certainly, a lot more of political activism, a lot more of you know, electioneering, the campaigns and all of that are going to be online. Yeah, they're going to be online. Most people want to participate and to watch from online, in preference to being in these physical spaces. At least online, you won't be shot. But that doesn't mean that there are no risks.
And I was going to say, like, finally, if you were to say one thing to a human rights defender listening to this podcast, how would you advise them to be safe?
Up your online security skills. There is a lot of resources available on how to secure yourself online, on how to use these online platforms in a safe way. And also just beware that attacks online usually translate to physical attacks. Yeah, they also translate to psychological attacks. So take care of your physical security. Do not ignore it. And also take care of yourselves. Pick up self-care practices to stay sane and to stay alive. Yeah. And these resources are available. Reach out when you need help, when you need support. Reach out. These people that's got your back out there. We are here. We are up to help.
Moses, I want to thank you so much for being on this Chapter 4 podcast. I imagine the next time we talk to each other, I'll be asking the question, so who defends the defenders?
Yes, that's a conversation we should have next. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. Yeah.